This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. During her tenure as head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christy Todd Whitman was often criticized by both environmentalists and industry. Yesterday, after she announced her intention to leave, many Greens described her tenure as a well-intended disappointment, while business lobbyists hoped for a successor who would be friendlier to industry. Christy Todd Whitman is a former two-term governor of New Jersey, and while she's always been on good terms with President Bush, she's been described as the odd woman out, a moderate Northeasterner in a conservative administration. Shortly after taking office, President Bush reversed his position on carbon dioxide emissions and withdrew from the Kyoto Treaty, despite his assurances to his new EPA administrator. And though she was able to push through some initiatives, Kyoto and a subsequent fumble on arsenic levels in drinking water left an impression of ineffectiveness. What will her departure mean for the future of this administration's environmental policies? Will they change? And how are environmental problems today different from 30 years ago when the EPA was established? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR's environmental correspondent, John Nielsen, and always good to have you here on the show.
Hello, Neil.
Christy Todd Whitman says she's leaving for family reasons, to go back to her family in New Jersey. Others say she is leaving out of frustration. Which is it?
Well, I called somebody on the phone yesterday to ask about that. Nobody ever believes it when a politician leaves for family reasons. And the response I got was it reminded this particular person of what happens when someone comes up to you in the hallway at your office and says, I just want you to know I'm not dating this other person, which is, you know, a sure sign that that's happening. And I think that those suspicions are raised by her undeniably rocky tenure. She, especially compared to a lot of the other people in the administration, which is known for uniformity of vision, she did get involved in a number of rather public spats. I called her on the phone and she said, you know, some people really do want to go home and be with their husband. I think it's the nature of the job. There's that adage that says if you run the EPA and you want a friend, get a dog. So that was part of it.
Well, when she was governor of New Jersey, she managed to straddle the issue. She was seen as friendly to business and to growth and to jobs and to the environment. Now, how did business and industry view her tenure as head of the EPA?
Actually, that's hard to say. I know that, and the reason it's hard to say is because a lot of those arguments went on behind closed doors. Many of the representatives of the energy industry, the oil companies, the electric companies, the coal companies in particular.
The people she regulated.
Yes, they felt very much like the feeling was that they had access to other parts of the administration. And the original fight over whether the president would regulate emissions of man-made carbon dioxide as a pollutant, that fight took place in part because the coal industry and the oil industry objected to what she was saying. And when she left yesterday, people did bring up, you know, they did have positive things to say about her. One representative of the energy industry said that he thought that she'd done a good job changing the direction of this institution towards something that was more business friendly, in the sense that it would encourage business to try and find their own ways to reduce pollution. But I think that they were being polite. I don't think there was a lot of satisfaction. I don't think that they really knew when her word would stick.
Environmentalists, on the other hand, seem to express a lot of disappointment. They had greater hopes for her, I guess, on the feeling she said their disappointment was a vast mischaracterization. You know, is that accurate?
Which part? The vast... the environmental community has been throwing around really operatic phrases in relation when they are asked to describe her legacy. The Natural Resources Defense Council has called it an unmitigated disaster for the environment, for example. Whitman's... And when you ask for examples, they cite a number of environmental changes, or a number of changes to important anti-pollution regulations, and they say that across the board, the changes made on Administrator Whitman's watch have been very, very business friendly, and they're going to lead to more pollution. What Whitman says is it's that she has tried to move the agency away from an all stick and no carrot approach to things, and that she should get credit for that, and she's not getting credit. And you know, the implication is it's not necessarily her job to please the environmentalists, it's her job to protect the environment. And sometimes there's a disconnect there.
That you can have be business friendly and pro-environment at the same time.
I think that's her belief. She also mentioned rather pointedly that some of the people who were complaining most loudly about her tenure as she was leaving just a few weeks ago were saying very, very nice things about a decision to sharply limit diesel emissions from off-road vehicles, but there wasn't a peep about that yesterday.
Now, is this going to be a political issue in the coming election?
Well, the environmentalists are going to try to make it a political issue. That's a tricky thing to do. It's hard to get voters to vote for candidates based on their environmental records. I think the environmental community thinks that the time is right to do this. I know that they feel it's true that they have not gotten very much attention. You don't get much attention on environmental issues when there's a war going on. I mean, one early sign of how this is going to play out is going to come when a successor is nominated. The environmentalists are going to try to turn those hearings into a referendum on all of the policies of the president. You know, and one analyst said, hey, put it this way, that the president could nominate Captain Planet to be the next person to run the EPA, and there would be a lot of objections. So we might get a good hint of whether it's going to play rather soon.
As we look at at her legacy, what would you say it is? I mean, are there clear achievements or failures, for that matter, that we can point to for this 2.5-year period?
Well, I don't think Administrator Whitman left as much of a stamp on institutional policies as some of her predecessors did. I think that she will be remembered for her decision to order General Electric to clean up the PCBs in the Hudson River, which she got a lot of praise for, the diesel rule, which she got a lot of praise for. And I think that she will also be remembered from trying to move away from environmental policies that are considered a success if they inspire a lot of lawsuits, as somebody put it to me. But it might be that the main impact is this institutional change. The EPA administrator has always been viewed as a watchdog, as someone who doesn't represent a human constituency so much as, you know, the water and the sky and the earth. And Administrator Whitman was criticized for that inside the administration. That's my hunch, and it's also my hunch that the nominee to replace her will be someone who toes the line much more, and that'll be a new thing for the EPA.
John Nielsen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
John Nielsen is NPR's environmental correspondent. He was with us here in Studio 3A. And joining us now to talk about the future of the EPA is Paul Portney, president of Resources for the Future, a nonpartisan public policy organization here in Washington, D.C. He's on the phone with us from Reagan National Airport, where he's waiting to board a flight to Boston. And thanks for taking the time to join us. Paul Portney, are you there? Well, we're going to check into the whereabouts of Mr. Portney. We thought we had him on the line from Reagan National Airport, but evidently he may have been disconnected while listening to the first part of the program, so we'll try to reestablish contact there. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking today about the legacy of Christy Todd Whitman, who announced her resignation as head of the Environmental Protection Agency yesterday, and she's planning to leave Bond, I think, later next month, and so we'll be talking about that. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get a call from Janet, who joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Wonderful show. And I wanted to say that some of us really do cast our votes based on environmental policies. And with the political landscape being as cluttered as it is in you know, with so many different issues, businesses, the economy, et cetera, some of us have had to decide on watershed issues. As for me, I vote on women's reproductive rights and environmental policy.
John Nielsen, we were fortunate that he stuck around here in Studio 3A, and let's bring him back in on this point. Has this proved to be a political issue with legs? Certainly a lot of people campaign on environmental issues.
It's true. It is generally thought, and people do vote that way. I didn't mean to suggest that nobody votes that way. But traditionally, it's been a small number of people in national elections and an even smaller number in presidential elections. The strategy usually is, or the thinking among the pollsters, is that if you succeed in characterizing your opponent as anti-environmental, not just as somebody that you have a better idea than, then it can become an issue. If people start to think that this person is out to pollute the air, then it almost, well, it's been described to me, it achieves sort of character issue status. But that is a difficult thing to do. And I have kept expecting it to be a prominent factor in a presidential election for a long time, and it has never quite happened.
Janet, do you think that it's an important political issue to people you know and the people you talk to?
Well, I'm an Oregonian, so we pride ourselves on our ability to select candidates that are going to consider the environment as a utmost part of the political decision-making process.
Okay.
So I would say yes. Most people that I know do make their choices based on that.
Thanks very much for the call, Janet, and we appreciate your timing as well.
Thank you, Neil.
Bye-bye. Paul Portney, I think, is back on the line with us. John Nielsen, and again, thanks very much for being with us. Paul Portney, are you there?
I sure am.
Okay, we apologize for
my fault.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I thought it was our fault.
You're off the hook.
Okay, good. Again, Paul Portney, president of Resources for the Future, a nonpartisan public policy organization here in Washington. And, Paul, as I asked John Nielsen earlier, what do you think Christy Todd Whitman's legacy is going to be?
Well, I think she took over what's a very difficult job, and I say that because in a Republican administration, you're always going to be scrutinized by folks who think that you're going to bend over backwards to make things easy for the business community, and so I think she was in a very unenviable spot. And I also think, Neil, that the nature of environmental problems today is very different than the problems that EPA encountered when it was created in 1970. So I think any administrator today is dealt a tougher hand than his or her counterpart 30 years ago.
The issues of clean water and clean air were sharper then?
Well, if you think about it, in 1969, the year before EPA was created, the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, Ohio, spontaneously combusted. That same summer, the air pollution in Pittsburgh got so bad that they had to turn the streetlights on at noon, and motorists who were out driving had to turn their car headlights on. So those were environmental problems that anybody could see. You didn't need a PhD in aquatic toxicology to realize that we needed to do something about water pollution and air pollution, et cetera. Now we've been at it for 33 years. We've made an awful lot of progress on a number of these pollution fronts. And the new problems now involve trace amounts of pollutants that are invisible. We can't see them. We can't smell them. Often we can't taste them. But some of them have subtle health effects. And so from a regulatory perspective, that job is much more complicated today than it was even 15 years ago, I would say.
We're talking about the EPA, the legacy of Christy Todd Whitman, and what's next for the Environmental Protection Agency after Christy Todd Whitman announced her decision to resign as of next month. When we come back from a break, more of your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later in the program, we're going to switch focus and talk about President Bush's charge yesterday that European concerns about genetically modified food are perpetuating starvation in Africa. That's later on Talk of the Nation. Right now we're talking about the Bush administration's environmental policies and how they may change when a new administrator is appointed to take the place of outgoing head Christy Todd Whitman, who announced her decision to leave yesterday. Our guest is Paul Portney, president of Resources for the Future, a nonpartisan public policy organization here in Washington. And, of course, we're inviting your calls as well. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we go to a caller? Chris joins us on the line from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hello, Chris. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air, Chris.
Hi, I have kind of a two-part question. Something involve your crystal ball. The first part is, what do you think the future holds as far as the Bush administration switching to a new administrator? Can we get a devil that's what we've got right now? The second question is, are there any real moves afoot to help us on the transportation side get away from such gas guzzlers and go to hybrids and other technologies? And I'll just take my answer off the air.
Okay, Chris, thanks very much. Paul Portney, I don't know if you're ready to tackle either or both of those.
Well, I'll plunge in on both, and you can bail me out, Neil, if you think I need it. With respect to the future EPA administrator, I'm not going to engage in speculation as to who it might be. There are already a million names being bruited about. I'll just come back to a point I made before, and that is that this is a very tough job, and I don't think any administration is clever enough to get somebody that will win over the hosannas of people in both the business and environmental community. You're always going to make one or the other group unhappy. On the transportation front, I think that that's a very good question. In St. Louis, as in Washington, D.C., and other cities around the country, traffic congestion becomes a bigger and bigger problem. It creates frustration. It adds to local air pollution. It burns up gasoline that makes us more dependent on petroleum, both domestic and imported. And it's a problem that we really have to deal with. There's no question about it. The number of vehicles per mile of road in the United States, I think, has doubled just in the last decade, and we buy new cars and drive them around faster than we can build highways, and that's one of the problems we'll have to address for both oil security reasons and environmental reasons, not to mention doing something about the frustration of traffic congestion.
Let me ask you about the political polarization and the environment, if you will, in which any EPA administrator has to work. During his appearance, John Nielsen was talking about the diesel emission standards that the EPA administrator, Christy Todd Whitman, came out with, last December, that were, you know, generally praised by environmental groups, yet they were excoriating her legacy in departure statements yesterday. Is there any way that you can't get caught up in this partisan issue politics in Washington?
No, I don't think there's any way that you can avoid it altogether. I think some EPA administrators in the past have done a more successful job of rising above the baser political debates. But any time, Neil, that you impose a regulation on one party that makes them bear costs they'd rather not bear for the benefit of someone else, you're engaged in a basic political process, much like you are in the tax debate, where if you raise taxes or lower taxes on someone to the benefit or detriment of someone else, you're always going to incur the ire of some party out there, and they're going to squawk about it.
Now, also, remind us what it is that the EPA does.
The EPA operates under seven major statutes that regulate both air and water pollution control, the control of garbage or solid waste, hazardous waste, drinking water, toxic substances and chemicals, and also abandoned hazardous waste disposal sites that are taken care of in what's called the Superfund program.
All right, let's get another caller. Wayne joins us now from Redwood City in California.
Yes, I just wanted to comment on Paul Portney's excellent comment about the trace materials and where we're going in the future. There's been an explosion in the science literature, in the environmental science literature, on where the exposures and what's in people's blood really is coming from. And today it's not coming from those old sources covered by those old laws, as I'm sure Paul Portney knows. It's coming from household products, indoor air, wood burning, all kinds of things that aren't really a priority. All I can say is since the science has exploded and changed, and the public needs to know about this because they can't act intelligently unless they know about it, I do indeed hope the next administrator has a very, very solid grasp of science.
Paul Portney?
I think Wayne is absolutely right. One of the additional problems for any EPA administrator now is that, in contrast to 30 years ago, when the pollution came out of easily identifiable smokestacks or outfall pipes that ran into streams or rivers, pollution now comes from much more dispersed sources, including the cars that we drive. We individually are significant air polluters now. But it comes from dry cleaners and small paint shops, and for that reason, no administrator can very easily go to one big source and say, there, I've required them to do this and thereby solve the problem. We're now dealing with smaller, more dispersed sources, and frankly, Neil, folks who don't think of themselves as polluters. And for that reason, too, it's a much more challenging job than it has been in the past.
May I add something?
Sure.
Not only does it come from those little sources, everybody thinks when they hear Paul Portney talk about that, he's talking about the outdoor pollutants emitted from the dry cleaning store down the street. It's not that way. You take the dry cleaning home, and when you do that, you put it in your closet, and it outgasses tetrachloroethylene and all kinds of toxic chemicals used to clean it, and that's what's in our blood. And the best single thing we could do is readjust to start looking for pollution in the right places instead of looking for pollution in all the wrong places, especially indoor air.
Thanks very much for the call, Wayne. Paul Portney, I wanted to ask you about a point that his question raises, and that is, what's the relationship of science and the EPA? Is there a squad of scientists who do testing for them?
Oh, sure. EPA has any number of very qualified scientific researchers themselves, and of course they depend on academics and other consultants who do state-of-the-art research. To pick up on the point that I made earlier and that Wayne reinforced about the problems being more subtle, Neil, I think what it means is that in contrast to the old days when just about anybody could see what the problem was and in some cases even guess at what a reasonable control strategy might be, the importance of scientific and even economic analysis now, I think, is much more important than it's ever been, because not only are the problems more subtle, because we've been regulating for 30 years and have already picked off the low-cost approaches to pollution control, each additional problem now tends to be a pretty expensive problem to deal with, and that's why good analysis that helps strike a balance between the health effects that we're trying to prevent and the economic impacts that we would like to minimize on the regulated parties, that kind of analysis is much more important now than it's ever been.
Okay, let's go now to Debbie, and she's on the line with us from Indianapolis.
Yes, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call. I really want to speak to some of the things that have already been stated as far as the relationship between business and environmentalists. I am an environmentalist avid. I contribute to the not-for-profits, and I'm a business consultant. And so I feel like I can sort of see, I know I can see the perspectives of both. And it seems as though we just keep drawing the line in the sand, and we're either for business or we're for an environment. And it seems until we can engage the conversation at a deeper level where, and Paul even mentioned when we regulate to the fact that businesses have to incur costs they don't want to incur. That's absolutely right. And the conversation then needs to be, there are costs that are greater that, and we all will pay eventually, but we keep deifying the other as the enemy or as stupid or not getting it, and we just keep fighting the same fight. And then my children and my children's children will end up really bearing the consequences of our short-sighted conversation. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Okay, Debbie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Paul?
Debbie, I'd love it if you would contribute to resources for the future. But apart from that commercial announcement, let me say that taking the long view of this, you're absolutely right. There will always be a tension between those who want more environmental protection and those who are concerned about meeting the costs of regulation, et cetera. But looking at this over 25 years, I actually have seen some progress. And what I mean is that even the strongest environmental advocates today realize that additional regulations cost money, that companies that manufacture things in the United States could decide to go offshore and manufacture these someplace else if they would have to meet less strict standards there. So the environmentalists, I think, are much more sophisticated economically than they were and more willing to find low-cost ways to meet strong environmental goals. By the same token, the business community, which, as you'll recall, in the early years of environmental protection, said they can't do this to us, we're going to make steel or we will produce cars in the way that we see fit. they now understand that environmental protection is an enduring public value, and that they have to be seen as environmentally responsible, or they will have a very tough time doing business. And so while from time to time this tension between economic growth and the environment flares up, over the long haul, I think both sides have moved a lot toward the center, and I think the range of the debate has been narrowed.
As you look at the range of issues that are coming up, and our earlier caller, Wayne, suggested that the next head of the EPA should be somebody who's scientifically literate, at the same time, given these difficult kinds of tensions, you could also see that somebody who'd been leaving as a scientist, you could say, boy, I hope the next one's a real politician.
Well, Neil, I agree, and I think one thing that it's important for everybody to understand is that while environmental protection requires top-notch science, careful economic analysis, etc., at its heart, it is a political decision. We elect a president who will appoint an EPA administrator to reflect the views of the administration and obviously the views that president feels he's been elected to uphold. To me, there's nothing wrong with saying that environmental regulation is political. The key is that those political decisions are informed to the greatest extent possible by the best objective peer-reviewed science and economic analysis, etc. All you want to ensure is that good analysis has a place at the table.
A bill has been introduced in Congress to elevate the EPA to a cabinet-level agency. What difference would that make, and what's the status of the bill right now?
That bill would make EPA a cabinet department would not have an overwhelming difference in EPA's powers at all. They would still be regulating under the same statutes that they regulate now. Arguably, the most important difference it would make is that in international environmental negotiations, where other countries' environmental heads have cabinet secretarial authority, typically they're ministers of the environment from their respective countries, it would make the EPA administrator a cabinet official who would be dealing with those people at the same rank. As a practical matter, Neil, I think that the head of the U.S. EPA has more or less been treated as a cabinet official, and so in some sense it would be more symbolically important than substantively.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Paul Portney is president of Resources for the Future, a nonpartisan think tank. He was with us from Reagan National Airport, and we wish him a good flight to Boston and hope that he makes it on time. Here in the news at NPR today, the United Nations Security Council has overwhelmingly approved a resolution to end sanctions against Iraq and empowering the United States and Britain to run the country. And President Bush went to Capitol Hill today, claiming victory after Congress reached agreement on his tax cut plan. The package, though, is about half the size of the one the president originally proposed. You can hear reports on both those stories from NPR's Vicky O'Hara and NPR's Andrea Seabrook later today on All Things Considered. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.